Welcome, listeners, to Time for an Awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. And with all that getting, get an understanding." Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the homepage, and catch the live stream from that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening, and catch the live broadcast there also. You can go to ourradionetwork.com. Again, that's ourradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. They broadcast out of the Black Belt and catch the live stream there. Or you can download TuneIn to any of your handheld devices. TuneIn is a free app. And in that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon, and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you have the Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, that's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. And there you'll always see interesting content being posted daily. And do me a favor, before you leave that page, just hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook. And Time for an Awakening Media is there also. Always full of the latest podcasts of the various programs on Time for an Awakening. Interesting articles that you can read, download at later times, or share with your friends, or products that you can purchase through the Time for Awakening store in our partnership with the bbtoomey.com. Again, check it out. Make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. Tonight, we're in discussion about a period in history that they talked about here recently. I don't think they talk about it enough, and especially among our circles, because it was a pivot point in this country's history. Right after the end of the Civil War, during the period they call Reconstruction, when a lot of our ancestors came out of that state of chattel enslavement, they started to go about to repair themselves as a people. And we're going to discuss some of that period tonight from an African-centered perspective, see how it relates to our struggle now, and some of the lessons we can learn, and maybe things that we can use that our ancestors attempted to do during that period. Dr. William Rogers of Black Reality Think Tank is scheduled to join us this evening. I think he was having a little difficulty there because he lost his phone in a Uber. Hopefully he'll be with us to join in this discussion this evening. But we'll be right back to get the program started after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening with your host, Brother Elliot. Sundays, 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Welcome back
to Time for an Awakening. And before we get started with our program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia at 7th and Arch Street. Brother Richard is with us. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Elliot.
How are
you doing there?
Great.
Good, good, good. I'm also enjoying the day and looking forward to this discussion. I think, as you said, it's very critical that we stay focused and kind of continue to develop out from this perspective, especially in this moment where they give us this legislative, supposed to be remembrance of 400 years from 1619 to 2019. This period is, and I liked how you opened the period where we dealt with repairing ourselves as a people,
mm-hmm.
you know, I mean, which is the basis of reparation.
You know, before we get started with that, Richard, I'd seen that you had posted on the site about people in the area coming down to the museum because it's, I think it's free of charge tomorrow, or you give what you want, or something like that. Pay what you want.
Right, right. Yeah, what I'm trying to do now, the museum at different points have kind of like an open house. People can come, and we're now scheduling for the docents to be able to, you know, take people who will come in, and it's free to come in. And it's a volunteer, or what I'm throwing out the term, utilizing my social responsibility as a docent, a tour guide, to take people, willing to take people at 3:30 through the museum, our three exhibits that we have there, and kind of do what we do here on Time for Awakening with the backdrop of our core exhibit, which is Audacious Freedom, the history of Black Philadelphia from 1776 to 1876, which is dealing with the period we'll be talking about tonight. And then the other exhibit is, and now it just popped in my mind, but the other two core exhibits that we're dealing with. And I just felt if people can come through, I can take them through that history and we can have dialogue, continue the dialogue around it. And I consider that a part of our political education part. So Tuesday, July 2nd, at the African American Museum of Philadelphia, if you're in the area, you can just come through. Usually people pay for these tours to at the museum. It's free. And come check us out, check me out, and put me in check if necessary as we go through the narrative. Because I think the period and Philadelphia being the place where the basis of this nation state and the question of being freed men is explored because of Philadelphia, one of the states that through its Gradual Abolition Act statewide provided freedom to Africans at a certain period of time in the birth of this nation state. It raises some critical.
Also, they're having a discussion, town hall meeting. I think it's at the press club down in Washington tomorrow.
Yes.
Also, Richard. Malik Zulu Shabazz, one of our former guests, Cam Howard, will be there. And it's a town hall meeting on reparations also. And I did notice that Talib Sabir is going to be there also speaking.
Right.
And he's Nataki's co-host on Let's Buy Black365.com. And I know he was involved in the Black Lawyers for Justice, so he's going to be there speaking also. So, you know, I'm glad this discussion is being developed among and its younger people. Talib is a young man. He's in his early 30s. You know, you got a cross-section of people that I seen that was down there that's going to be presenting at the National Press Club. So, go ahead.
And I really like that the ideal is to do what, you know, people are throwing out different points, but raise the questions of what is it that, how do we see reparations, right? What is it that we want from reparations? And I think that that's really, I'm glad to see that that's being, you know, developed in that press conference. you know, the whole question of reparations. So that's good to see.
Yeah, so I'll touch base. I mean, there's several people that I can touch base with to kind of see how things went, to talk about it. We can get a hold. In fact, I might try to get a hold of Talib. He's a little different because we've had Cam Howard on. In fact, I want to touch Cam Howard because there's several things that I want to talk with him about, the convention. Also, you know, being down in Washington during that period when they were doing some initial discussions. So, and Malik, he hasn't been on in quite a while. So, it's a couple of people that we can reach back to kind of get caught up on some of the things that's been happening in some of these discussions that, you know, we haven't been able to attend. But it's a good thing that we've had people that've been on the program that are active out there that can discuss these things and bring back information. So that's in itself, that's good. You know, we were supposed to have Dr. Rogers involved in the discussion, but I think he messaged me earlier through one of the other brothers and said that he had lost his phone in an Uber, but he was still going to try to reconnect, if he can, he can. We're going to continue the discussion. Hopefully he can still join us.
Yeah, I was looking forward to having Dr. Rogers on, you know, because he offers, you know, in his experience, definitely a full breadth of, you know, information and how do we could pull this thing and develop this thing. You know, again, what you said about the African-centered perspective, you know, it's like really critical that we have our whole own narrative voice in relationship to how we tell a historical story, right? Because it sets, as Dr. Clark says, it sets the basis of how we should be organizing, as far as I'm concerned. And if our narrative is based off of somebody else, then we're organizing to support somebody else compared to our own selves.
Yeah, well, listen, Richard, that period, now they did a, Henry Louis Gates did a three or four part, a presentation on that period of history. With Gates, for me, and this is just me personally, Gates have good information when he does his documentaries, right. But his perspective is lacking as far as I'm concerned, because he doesn't give a African-centered perspective. Mm-hmm. It's usually a Eurocentric perspective, and it doesn't really go deep enough as far as I'm concerned. And I think he can do that because he not only has access, but he has the time and the money has been given to him to do these things. He can go deeper if he chooses to. He chooses to deal with it from that perspective. So I guess you can take what you can get from it. Like I said before, a lot of his documentaries have good information. And for somebody that's really looking to go deeper, they can use his information and kind of go a little bit deeper than what he does. I think it was good because it let people know about some information during that period of time that they might not have been aware of before. One of the things I kind of wanted to start off the conversation with, Richard, is during that period, right after the Civil War was over, and this country, you keep in mind that Lincoln wasn't interested in freeing any slaves.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he had a couple of discussions before, and it's in print, where he said that he wasn't interested in freeing slaves, and if he could continue slavery as it was, he would have done that. But after a succession of losses during the Civil War, and his back was against the wall because the Union was in a tenuous situation, he took Douglas up on that offer that Douglas had always been extending about letting blacks fight in that war. And our ancestors got involved in the war, and once they did, the tide quickly changed to the point where the North won the war. He sent Sherman, and we had talked about it before, down to talk with an embassage of our ancestors in Savannah, Georgia, to kind of gauge what blacks wanted out of this. A couple things I want to start off the conversation with. It's two things that they came with a consensus opinion with. And if you remember, Richard, the gentleman that was doing the talking, and his name escapes me, because I think it was 53 representatives. Mm-hmm. The older gentleman that spoke for them mentioned that they all didn't see it or didn't agree to their initial opinions. They didn't agree as far as, well, let me read it first, the two things. The question that was raised by this Union General Thurman, Sherman, William T. Sherman, it says, state what manner you think you can take care of yourself and how you, how we can best assist the government maintaining your freedom. His answer was, our ancestor's answer was, the way we can best take care of ourselves is to have our own land and turn it and till it by our own labor. That is, by the labor of our women, the children, and the old men. We can soon maintain ourselves and have something to spare. We want to be placed on our own land until we're able to buy it and make it our own. Placed on land until we're able to buy it and make it our own. The next question was, state which manner you would like, or you would rather live, whether scattered among whites or in colonies yourself, by yourself. The answer, we would prefer to live by ourselves, but there's a prejudice against us in the South that will take years to get over. But I do not know that I can answer for all of my brother. Lynch says that he thinks they should be separated. All other persons present were questioned one by one. Answer they gave agreed with Brother Frazier. So, if you notice, Richard, I got it wrong, because he answered, you still there?
Yeah.
Yeah, he answered that I can't speak for my brother, but we would rather live separate. Because I don't think, and I'm paraphrasing now, that, what did he say here? The prejudice against us in the South will take years to get over. And he said that I don't know if I can answer for my brethren. So they were polled, all of them. And it says here in the written record that all of them agreed with Brother Frazier. So the ancestors then wanted to live by themselves. And it's something here, Richard, that I just noticed, and I read it before. It says they wanted to be placed in land till they were able to pay for it themselves.
Sounds right.
They didn't want to necessarily be given land.
Right.
They wanted to be left alone, develop and work the land, earn enough money, and pay for it themselves. So,
yeah.
From that point, our ancestors went off of that premise. You can see it from history. They went off of that premise of living by themselves and developing the land. And then we see what happened after that. They not only went off of that premise of living, of trying to live by themselves and develop the land, educationally. It was a lot of institutions that were started during that period, Richard.
Mm-hmm.
It was a couple up here in the North in Pennsylvania that were started before that. But a lot of the ones that we kind of recognize now were either started during that period or shortly after that Reconstruction period ended. Clark, Howard, Morehouse, was all started between the years of 1865 and 1867. Spelman, Tuskegee, Hampton was started in 1868. Spelman and Tuskegee was started a little after that period. I think it was 1880, if I'm not mistaken. But all of those schools of higher learning were started during that period. And I'm not even talking about the secondary type of education, the rudimentary education.
Right.
Those schools was of a higher learning.
Right.
And during that period, Richard, our ancestors was basically an illiterate population because they wasn't allowed to read.
Mm-hmm. You know, Elliot, if I may, because it's an important point to bring up, that those, as you said, were the higher education institutions that were created at that time. But another level of infrastructure that would be the feeder to those institutions was those primary schools that you always make reference, that a lot of times were in churches, or they had individual teachers that were teaching in, you know, these freed men and women actually supported to make sure that the children get that primary education so that they could be able to go to those institutions of higher learning. This was a drive, just like, and again, bringing out that thing about land and being to a drive, a value, a belief they had, and they translated into behavior to support their own educational institutions, and knew that it was necessary in order to build a life for themselves.
Yeah, and move the people forward. They knew that they had to be educated. I put a note here on my notes here, and let me read this, because I pulled it up from one of the sites that was talking about Reconstruction. It says, before the Civil War ended, only a small percentage of African Americans knew how to read and write.
Mm-hmm.
But during the period of Reconstruction, there was such a motivation in the African American community that by the turn of the century, the majority of African Americans could read and write. Many teachers commented that their classrooms were filled with both young and old grandfathers with their children and grandchildren, all eager to learn. Go ahead.
No, it's just, you know, and it's important for the listening audience to hear what you just said. Because if we compare that to now, we have to ask the question, what is the difference between then and now, and why that energy and drive is not similar? But that educational attainment by a population, which was not a small population, but 2 million? People who were released out of federal and state bondage, with limited skills, and to be able to do that in 30 years, from 1865 to 1900,
to the turn of the century. Yes,
you know, that is a remarkable. I mean, they are looking at nations now, you know, in relationship to, you have to, the people have to have a willingness to the babies that is important. And that's a series of belief systems that informs them, that would make them want. So, and as you say, and that was going along with, we need just a space. We ain't asking for the space to be given to us. We're going to buy it. So they are really saying that, you know, I mean, we have to put those dots together, I think, Elliot. They're saying, if we get the space and educate ourselves, you give and leave us, and we are left alone to our own design, we'll buy the land with it that we're on. We ain't, you know, those men said that as leaders, that was a guaranteed business deal. It wasn't no, you know, give me. I don't know if that makes sense, but that seems, you know, important to me.
Well, our ancestors knew that they could do this. You know, the questions that was asked by this Sherman you know, almost like he was talking to children, whether you can take care of yourself. Our ancestors was fully aware that they could take care of themselves. A lot of the trades we were already doing.
Right.
The agriculture, the building trades, like you said before, the blacksmithing, the barbering, all of the trades, we were already doing those. So the expertise was there. It's just the educational part, knowing how to read and things of that nature, where you could sign a contract, things that they couldn't do that.
Right.
So they went about trying to educate themselves where they could fulfill other areas that was needed. Now, when I read that portion about everybody in class learning together, let me read this because it focuses in on this state in particular of Georgia, because several black schools of higher learning sprang up out in the state of Georgia. It says, for freed people opened the first schools, and this is talking about secondary education, in early 1865. They were crowded to overflowing. Within 1 year of black freedom, over 8,000 former slaves were attending schools in Georgia. 8 years later, black schools struggled to contain nearly 20,000 students. So you can see that the overwhelming majority of our people were trying to get educated.
I'm excited and emphasizing that because you know, when we're dealing with you know, looking at the history of that period of black reconstruction, and I'm glad you even brought out about Gates, that we have to really continue to assess the then versus now. I think, you know, and I think that that's important. But I, you know, Elliot, the thing as I was also preparing for this, and it brings this point up that you're raising when you're talking about, and I'm going to start with this thought, and I kind of allude to it. The distinction between freedmen and free men. The people in the South at that period, the men who were approached that were leader, they were freed men. They weren't free men, if that makes sense.
Certainly.
Which means that the question is that, you know, and then it goes to this drive and, you know, maybe geography and different outlooks. Freedmen said they wanted land that they would purchase at a period in time, wanted to live to by themselves. And they believed that they understood that there was a certain mindset amongst whites that would not accept them. This was freedmen. But freemen had a mindset, let's call them abolitionists, to put another piece of cloth on this goose. There was a sense that of among some, mostly in the North, and maybe in the Midwest, Ohio, that blacks and whites could be able to live and work and build in together. That's the interpretation I walk away from my understanding of history. So I think that that's an important understanding in relationship to when we're talking about the politics and the economy, that freedmen were now engaging on their own. As you said, they already had skill sets, right? And that's the economy of the North and the South, is those skill sets were going to be placed in the same box, if you know, being colloquial, as white skill sets, and they were more advanced and more numerous in certain states. Mississippi, Georgia, South Carolina. So what they do, creating an economy of their own, harvesting land, producing products. And it was interesting in that statement, they said primarily to feed themselves and with the extra. So what were they going to do with the extra? It seems to me they were going to trade.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. You know that was going to be next.
You know, but freemen, they didn't have the same, wasn't, in the North, it wasn't about, even though there were towns developed by Black, it wasn't the same level of understanding of those two elements. We want land unto ourselves. We want to be unto ourselves, and we want to produce and trade from what we produce, and we're willing to do business in purchasing the land and do commerce and dealing with putting our skills and our surplus on the open market. I'm saying that because it seems to be, we have to factor those realities in when we're talking about what happens later in relationship to within us itself.
Yeah, listen, I'm sorry. I do agree that because some of those things that they wanted to do, we can use history as a guide to see that they were derailed. The thing, hopefully, we'll touch on some of it tonight is why. Because that's a key question that some of our people don't really understand now. And you can hear it in some of the conversation. I want to touch back to something that the men stated again. Our ancestors left a record, and it was recorded in the annals of history. When the man asked them what they wanted to do, and they said that they wanted to live by themselves. But notice what they stated. They didn't say, well, we hate whites,
right,
and we can't live with them. Although our ancestors had a legitimate right to hate every white person they saw. They did. Because of what was done to our people over hundreds of years for no real reason. They said that the whites hate them so much it would take years for them to get over it.
Mm.
I analyze that statement, Richard.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Analyze that statement.
Mm-hmm.
They said, well, we want our own land because the hatred these people have for us, it'll take them years to get over.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's you know, what comes to my mind as you bring that up, Elliot, because in that period at the elite level, the white academic level, what they were constructing, and this was not, I mean, they were constructing this here conception of human order differently, right? They call it scientific racism. They were putting it, I mean, in going to this, because they, I mean, it was subtle though. Now, the before it was overt, you know, we're entitled by God to suppress you. Now they were coming up with rationale of order, laws of nature, of why blacks were supposed to, Africans were supposed to be dominated. This was coming out of the academy, while at the same time the nation state was trying to hold off. As you said, Lincoln was just saying, I wouldn't have let and freed those your property if I didn't, but y'all are so hell bent on making your own nation, and we're hell bent on keeping us both together. So scientific racism really reinforces that hatred. I mean, it's subtle. It's not pushing about equality. At the same time, they were asking this question, what do you want for yourself? the military is saying one thing and the academy, white academy, is saying something else. I just thought that that's important when we're looking at that period, that those are the dynamics that are going on. There's a lot of moving parts that from that point of the African Center perspective, we should be clear of, because it raises some questions of the then and now to me.
Now, before I touch on some of the other things, because I want to kind of touch on three different areas, Richard, politically, economically, and educationally. We talked some about education and what our ancestors tried to do during that period. Let me, before I move over into the political piece and the economic piece, let me read the three amendments that was ratified during that period, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment. Everybody's familiar with that 13th Amendment to the United States Constitution, abolishing slavery and involuntary servitude except for punishment of a crime. So it was a little double talk there. Slavery was never abolished. Now, let's look at that 14th and 15th. The 14th Amendment to the Constitution, ratified in 1868, granted citizenship to all persons born or naturalized in the United States, including former slaves, and guaranteed all citizenship rights and equal protections of the laws. One of three amendments passed during Reconstruction era to abolish slavery and to establish legal rights for Black Americans. It would become the basis of many landmark Supreme Court decisions over the years. The 15th Amendment, granting African Americans the right to vote, adopted into the U.S. Constitution in 1870. So we can see by history looking back that none of those amendments to the quote-unquote highest document in this land was worth the ink that they wrote on the paper. It wasn't worth a grain of salt, because the same legislative body that passed them basically tore them up, spit on them. They weren't any good. To the point where in 1865, they had to do a new Voting Rights Act all over again when it was already in the Constitution 100 years before that. And not for minorities, for Black folks. That's what those amendments were supposed to have been for. And now the thing is, Richard, is this. Let's look at this. Lincoln sent Sherman down there to talk with Blacks after the war was won to see what they wanted. These amendments were passed in the highest office in the land and added to the Constitution. What was their motive? Now, when I say what was their motive, just in anything, and you can see historically, when you look at things that Europeans have tried to do in reference to Black people, that they always had an ulterior motive or backup plan. I think, and this is just me, I want your opinion on it, I think when they seen how rapidly our people were moving to become independent, that it had to be stopped. Because two things I notice, and the question comes up now, is that, and you hear Black folks saying it, and I'll use I see somebody getting ice cream or something outside your door. I'll use this term that they use when they're referring to this president now, Richard, about, oh, you know, he does this. Poor whites don't realize that he's against them, too. You've heard those type of remarks, right, Richard?
Yes. Yes.
Now, let's look back during this period. When our people were doing what they were doing, our ancestors were doing what they were doing during this Reconstruction period, It was detrimental to two people. It was detrimental to white landowners, and it was detrimental to what they considered poor whites at that time. You were a danger to both of them. Because poor whites didn't have any skills during that period. Martin Luther King even said it in one of his speeches that they built land-grant colleges to teach white people how to farm. You remember that?
Right.
They didn't have any marketable skills. They didn't know anything about how to do certain things. You see that they knew how to be cops, constables on patrol. They knew how to be brutal to our ancestors if they tried to run away. They had that skill. That was always there. But if you notice, the white landowners, with black people controlling millions of acres of land and control and involved in the food supply, knowing how to produce food for this country, and would be eventually heavily involved in the food supply of this nation, that couldn't be allowed as far as Europeans were concerned. If you had a integrated country as is purported, then it would seem to me that whoever does it is good for the country, but it wasn't good for you to be doing it. They never wanted you to do this. They never wanted blacks to be totally independent. It was a danger to them, both poor whites and whites with means, to have blacks successful, independently successful. So deals were made in the highest office in this land to turn the tables on black people and put them back in a state of servitude for almost the next 100 years.
You know, I agree. And you know, it's interesting because I don't know how to, because we have to continue to frame the point that you're making, right? That black people's productive, self-serving, self-asserting productive reality in the political and the economic sphere is a threat to specific interests that have been running this country from its inception, right? I was looking, so from the legal perspective that I think that I wanted to interject in that to reinforce, how did those two groups, and I want to add another group to that, the Republican reformists, that the Northern Republican elite reformists that were supporting Africans, you know, supposedly liberation struggle that they were engaged in. But the thing about this nation, when we deal with that this is a nation of laws, that I think that, I mentioned it Friday, that I think that when we talk about Reconstruction, we can never lose sight of. And that is the Dred Scott decision.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, that, you know, supposedly the 13th, 14th, and 15th was supposed to nullify that. But that Supreme Court decision was the basis of how the nation came down, those guys who, how they viewed black people. Because the only reason why you can take something from them or they're not entitled, if you don't believe they have any rights to have it in the first place, even if you give it to them temporarily. And the Dred Scott decision seems to me to reinforce what comes out of the Jim, leads up to the Tillman Hayes or the Jim Crow, which says taking back the reason why the federal troops leave and the states take over. But this other, these Republican, Northern Republican liberals, I want to add to that mix that you mentioned, Elliot, of poor whites and Southern white landowners.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And if I can get just this one paragraph out of this book, The Facts of Reconstruction.
Go ahead.
It's dealing with essays from John Hope Franklin, but this I'm hoping this goes in there. Historians long have recognized that the defection of self-consciously reform-orientated Republicans played an important part in the decline of the radical Republicanism. And that's what Lincoln was supposed to be, right? A radical Republican, right? And the abandonment of the Southern Republicans in the 1870s. The reformers included academics such as Charles W. Eliot, David A. Wells, Francis Lamberth, and Amasis Walker, literaries and editors such as Horace White of the Chicago Tribune, Edwin L. Godkin of the New York Nation, James Russell of the Tribune, Charles Eliot Norton of the North American Review, George William Curtis of Harper's Valley, and Park Goodwin, and Charles Nedhoff of the New York Evening Post. And these are the papers, right? And intellectually inclined businessmen and lawyers such as Edward Arkinson, John Murray Forbes, Dorman B. Easton, and Richard Henry Dana. These men identified themselves as the intellectual elite, the best of men, who bore special responsibility to the nation, but who also were entitled to special deference. During the war and the early years of the Reconstruction, most of them had been firm supporters of radical anti-slavery action, providing an intellectual foundation and political support for radical Republican demands for emancipation and equal rights. As Franklin complained, however, when the final Republican Reconstruction policy took shape, these former advocates of strong measures against the South turned their fire on those attempting to carry out the strong measures. That's not in the South. That's not the poor whites. And that's not the Southern landowners. That's the Northern. You see, a lot of that was media, owners of media, who were Republicans,
mm-hmm.
who supported, because the Northern, to get this here idea, the Northern whites were in support. Republicans were in support. And Philadelphia said the Union League, the basis of the Republican Party was started, right? So what I'm saying is the anti, out of this, but I believe it's out of the same fear
mm-hmm.
that you mentioned, that they all agreed that Black people shouldn't release that economic, social, and cultural dynamo in this country.
Exactly.
Under their own auspice.
Exactly. Exactly.
Which goes back to the Dred Scott. They have no right that we have to honor. Seems to me. And that's a political and economic and positioning that I think that we should understand was the only way that could come into being for those who did look at Henry Louis Gates. And if I may add, Elliot, you know, because I think this is what Dr. Malveaux was trying to make the point at the reparations congressional hearing around H.R. 40, why she was so adamant about bringing up Wilmington on fire. The length of that economic dynamo being unleashed, what it did, and the response because of what it did by those who were closer to it, and that gets into those white landowners and the poor whites.
And poor whites.
That was there.
Exactly.
But
Richard, when you hear people now expressing that it should be some allegiance with poor whites. Historically, that has never been the case. So what are we saying? When you hear blacks use that conversation about, oh, he's doing something to poor, I don't know why they're voting for him. He's not voting in their interest. Poor whites and blacks ought to have some allegiance. There was never any historical allegiance between poor whites and blacks.
Any whites
for that matter, and blacks. Yeah. Sure, you could point out a case here and there, but I'm talking about systematically, because if it was any type of real initiative or real care or real heartfelt need to do right by people that have been wrong for hundreds of years, it would have been done already. It would have been done.
They would have brought it out up as a part of their moral imperative.
Yeah, exactly.
Not been have to be, coerced. Not that black people have to, that whites confront whites. Now, the question is the numerical thing. But, we go on down the line and we see that these people, look, Ellie, I'm not one that not understand that it may be this thing called human nature to look out for your best interests. So here comes the people, even though subjugated for over directly for over 246 years by 1865, by every aspect culturally, legally. Another group of people have been given identifier called white over that time period and privileges to give them some indication that they might be able to get access, because white males didn't have land, you didn't have no right to vote.
Mm-hmm.
Poor whites. Right?
Yeah.
So their whole thing was their aspiration as they came as immigrants early on as indentured and later on as people fleeing, hostile environments, whether that be Ireland, Scotland, Italy, England, and coming someplace where they can see a better life for themselves. Even though a people is already here that they know has been legally and culturally subjugated, they're willing to participate for their better life. So understanding human nature, I got that. So the question is, not that poor whites aren't looking out for their own interests, but when we take, say, as you say, started, when we look at the African-centered perspective, those leaders who, you said Sherman, General, when he asked them, that you can't get no more nationalistic than that, and nonviolent. Look, all I want to do is get some land of my own, leave y'all alone, educate my own. And in that quote, they said to have the women and men. So they didn't exclude women.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of funny. I'm glad you mentioned that, Richard. Now, that Europeans had a different mindset, come from a different culture. They excluded women. Women weren't involved in things they were doing. But you notice what our ancestors said, that they wanted the women involved in whatever they was doing. They mentioned old men and children. They mentioned a total family.
Right.
A total family. And I guess that left Sherman scratching his head.
Mm. And understanding black people have been under military occupation. Before it was under business occupation, right? It was under merchants. When he came, he was representing the president, but he was also representing the military commander, the national military commander, and asking a question to what they would call contraband. That's what the military called all those members who were, because those Africans that fought in the Civil War, those people gathered around the areas where they, those colored soldiers, the camps that they were in, the people lived around those camps. And the Union soldiers and officers called them contraband. So we have been under it's the military asking them, what you going to do? And it's the military that pulled out of the South and turned to the states to create state terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't do it while the Union military was there. They did it after, and it was the president, it was out of the electoral process, because I think Hayes had the popular vote and not the electoral vote, and they made a compromise in order to be able to for him to actually win, if I got that understanding correct. And that was the agreement, which they call that Tillman Hayes compromise, to pull out the Union troops.
And you were the compromise.
Right.
You were at the source of that compromise. You know, before we take a break, I'm going to take a little brief break. We come back, we continue the conversation, and people can get involved by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Richard, when we talk about this, we always got to flip the script and see how it relates to now. And what we could do moving forward, learning the lessons from our ancestors. Now, let me read to you, because I wrote it down. Two things that Gates pointed out during that documentary. And I wrote his exact words. It says that after 1865, when that Voting Rights Act was passed, and blacks were voting. It says the black vote elected Ulysses Grant in 1868 and 1872. The black vote, that back then.
Mm-hmm.
It says in 1860, 90% of blacks were enslaved. By 1870, 10 years later, 80% of black men were registered to vote. Now, let's look at that vote, because I think that's key. According to what Gates stated in the documentary, and that's why I like some of his documentaries, because of the information.
Mm-hmm.
He said that the black men that had become, that were being elected to office and down in the black belt, had two missions in mind. Number one, he said they wanted to improve their communities. Because, now I don't know whether he's saying this or he'd seen some documentation in reference to this, but he said because in their minds they had something to prove to white people.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second thing is they wanted to be economically independent from white society. So let's look at those two things that Gates said that our ancestors that first went into these seats, these office seats, whether they were legislators or congresspeople, the two things they had in mind, they wanted to improve their communities and they wanted to be economically independent.
Mm.
Now, that had to be the case because if you remember when we had some of the guests on that was doing the historic black town preservations, you remember?
Yes. Yep.
I went back to their site and pull up some of the information. And let me read this. It says more than 1,200 black settlements and towns were established in the United States between the late 18th century and 1800s and early 20th century. More than 500 settlements were established with physical elements and cultural institutions in the town format. Only 50 to 60 black towns were legally incorporated in the 19 states between in the 19th century between 1865 and 1915. Now, okay, it says only 50 to 60 black towns were legally incorporated. But let's go back to what is initially stated. Over 1,200 black settlements and towns were established in the United States during that period. And more than 500 settlements were established with physical elements and cultural institutions in the town format.
Mm-hmm.
This is after chattel enslavement. So that showed you that the black elected official during that period was all about his people, period. Because it had to be money generated to do that, Richard.
Mm-hmm.
And if they were providing the tax base for those areas, a la agriculture, a la trades,
mm-hmm.
then they were going to rapidly be able to control things politically in key areas of this country. That's why I'm saying, you know, it wasn't about any poor whites and this the Democratic Party at that time. Blacks were Republican. It wasn't about that. It was about white society, whether they poor or rich, saying we cannot allow this. They were going to control things politically in this country if the mindset of our people continued the way it was. And that's some of the things that we have to look back historically and see where our ancestors kind of fell down on the job. Because when we came out of that state of chattel enslavement, Richard, and we're trying to repair ourselves socially, politically, and economically, one thing that we didn't do, and maybe we didn't have the expertise necessarily at that time, was repair ourselves mentally. You had all types of people. You had what you consider Uncle Toms. You had traitors. You had everybody that was all mixed in with our people. And I'm talking about black.
Mm-hmm.
And that mindset was detrimental. Because look at the politician now. Look at the black politician then. And look at the politician now. Does he have those two things that Gates pointed out in his own documentary? Do they have those two things in mind? Gates himself said that black politician during that period, by 1870, 80% of black men were registered to vote. And voting, they voted for white candidates. He said they put Grant in office twice.
Right.
But they voted for their own. And it said the black politician at that time, two things was on his mind primarily. He wanted to improve black communities and help black communities be economically independent. Is that the mission of these black politicians now? They say it is. Their actions prove exactly the opposite. They're not improving the life in black communities. Look at all these cities and small towns. Unemployment is spiraling out of control. Youth unemployment is off the charts. Violence is out of control. And that's another thing that wasn't present during that period. And they don't intend for blacks to be economically independent, the black politician here. How can I say that? Because they're not developing any businesses in their own communities. How are you supposed to become economically independent without any businesses, Richard? So is something wrong with the mentality of this black politician now that wasn't present during our ancestors during that period?
I do have a question on that, though, Elliot.
Go ahead.
And a different perspective in the sense of that, because as you laid out so rightfully, for those many towns to be, for those many people to be engaged in the voting process, and those many towns to be created. Again, I'm using the term. There was a lot of individuals in those communities that had the social responsibility that recognized that those communities had to be built. Mm-hmm. You said that you recognized that he said they built not only the educational institutions, the cultural institutions, they built all the institutions to reinforce the mindset that we are a community. And they exhibit that with their, what I'm calling that social responsibility, which is the basis of economic development and social responsibility. And it is a then and now, right? If you got social responsibility, meaning, as we later said, each one teach one, each one's responsible for the other. What you create is a network, which is called then social capital. With social capital, you can produce individual entrepreneur business people to move and purchase, as those gentlemen said, and what we calculated, they bought at least 22 million acres of land.
Mm-hmm.
They wasn't given 22 million acres of land. They bought 22 million acres of land. So what I'm saying is the difference between now, when you have what I call individual political entrepreneurs and individuals within the community, is that the people who are in the community, we don't display the generation. If you don't display, the only time that you're going to come out in 80 and 90 percentile to vote, period, is for a rock star because he's the first black president. Then you're not displaying no social responsibility for your community. Therefore, selecting reinforcing and supporting the individuals who say, I'm going to go for that office to do those, and I'm going to implement the improvement of our community and the economic independence. And those people say, yes, we're going to support you out of that social capital. Social responsibility is like volunteerism to me. You volunteer. You say, I want our community to be as great and good. You showed it. Those old men sitting in the classroom with those young people. I want to learn just like you want to learn. They want to learn. They need to learn. And I'm right here with them. Now we don't. Do we have that? Somewhere along the line that got lost. And my point that I raised, Elliot, that we can look as, because when he was asking, the military was asking them that, they responded from a non-violent position. I need clarification on that. Because it seemed that they were saying, if y'all left me alone, we already know whites is going to, they're not partial to us. So we ain't saying if they come with their stuff, got our stuff. And that's to the military too. They're saying, if you just leave us alone, we as a community will build, and y'all ain't even got a word from about us taking anything from you because we'll buy it.
That's what they said.
But what they were on the assumption was that the military was going to always protect them, that you didn't have to protect yourself. And when the Union leader, the Union Army left, and the undercover Confederates was able to come back, there was no defense for the development of that economic development in any of those, would you say 1,200?
Yeah, that's what they have listed on the site. It was over 1,200 black towns. I mean, you know, during that period, that had sprang up during that period.
And we can only assume history is not, and you know, kind of looking at, and you know, and then we have to ask, well, why in this moment you didn't put in place in your social, a part of your social responsibility, something that will protect you from hostile whites, poor people, hostile landowners, used to be landowners, hostile military, because the Union soldiers didn't want those contraband around. He's around. A hostile intellectual community. Why you didn't put anything in place to protect you from that? And the only thing I can come up with that we see and they celebrate in the civil rights era is this value, this belief, which turns into this behavior of a nonviolent behavior. I think we have to look at that.
Well, wait a minute, Richard. Hold it. Now, hold it now. I'm going to stop you. Where does that come from? Where does that come from? See, a lot of people don't want to point. They say you're pointing fingers. See, you, listen, when you have an intellectual discussion or an open discussion on these matters, then you have to put everything on the table. You have to. Yeah. There's no sacred cows. And that's an excellent question. That if our people, our ancestors, thought of everything that they needed to do to develop agriculture. Now, I'm going to read this again, Richard. Over 1,200 black towns and enclaves popped up during this period. More than 500 settlements were established with physical elements and cultural institutions attached to the town format. Now, that's great. They had cultural institutions attached to the town. What that means to the listening audience, Tom for Wickney, don't need me to explain it, but I'll use an example of a Tuskegee. It's a cultural institution attached to that town. Hampton is another one. It's a cultural institution attached to that town. From what this documentation states, and that's from one of our sites, one of the people that was on, that's the head of the Black Preservation of Town Society, said that there was over 500 settlements that were established with physical elements and cultural institutions attached to that town. Number one, we don't even know those 500 towns. I'm thankful that we got people out here that's still trying to preserve the memory of those, but we don't know those. We should know them. We should know them because our ancestors built them.
Right.
But the thing is, to go back to your question, Richard, we had the expertise to develop these towns, develop agriculture and cultural institutions to bolster these towns and to anchor these towns, but you don't come up with a militia or military to protect your towns, knowing that the men already said in their own statement that whites hate them. It had to be, Richard, some type of religious belief that God would protect them. And they didn't have to do it. It had to be. What other reason can you come up with, Richard?
Elliot, I mean, you got me there because that goes back to your mentality, a certain mentality. If that value is, and I'm calling it a value, and Amos tells us social values direct social behavior to solve specific problems, social problems. Well, obviously, they had the value of independence, economic independence, education, to solve the problem of that time. Voting. But they didn't have the value, the belief, the series of belief systems to be a part of, to set a part of that social construction to protect. So the question as you're raising, then why?
And Richard, listen, we're going to take a break, but let me say this before we break. It wasn't like these attacks happened at once, like a blitz attack. Then you could see what all our ancestors were caught off guard, even though they should have protected themselves. It wasn't like a blitz attack where 100 towns were attacked at once. A lot of these attacks and burnings and mass murders occurred during different periods. So we had the advent of information to say, wait a minute, Mount Bayou was attacked. Wilmington was attacked and burned. We have to protect ourselves. Wilmington happened in what, 1890 something, Richard? 98?
Right. Yeah.
Black Wall Street, Tulsa, Oklahoma, that was in 1921. I mean, and I'm just using that as an example.
We're trying to trace the pattern from that period to now. And as you say, I mean, when I was thinking of, you know, the Red Summer, 1919. I mean, you know, and going back, the mobilization of Black, there was discussions for the mobilization of Black men to enter into the war, the Civil War. There was discussion. There was debate. Should we fight? So that's a white man war.
So wait a minute. So you mean to tell me when white folks made the call for our ancestors to put on a uniform and put on and grab a weapon, that we did it, but when it came to protecting our men, women, and children, that we didn't do it? Richards, is that what you're saying?
And that's, I'm just throwing it out there, Elliot.
We got to have critical discussion on this. We can't gloss over this period in history. This period in our experience here, Richard, this Reconstruction was an important period. Because yes. Our ancestors did some things that could have turned the tide for our people in this country. We wouldn't have to be demanding these people give us reparations. This right. whole historical paradigm could have been changed. Can you imagine, Richard, what could have been occurring in 2019 if those things had been, if we had tweaked things a little bit during that period? We wouldn't have to worry about building a relationship with the mother continent, trying to fight this system of white supremacy and colonization on the continent, because both of us are suffering from colonized minds, whether right. you're on the continent or here or in the islands. We're all suffering from colonized minds. Everything would have been different. This man realized that. He said, we cannot allow this. We're going to take a break and come back and continue this discussion. And you can get involved, too. You don't just have to sit out there and hear us talk. You can call 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. It's a critical discussion on this period in our history. Everything don't have to be about, oh, look at these people, look what they're doing. We need to be doing something. And the answer ain't sitting back calling these people all kind of names. Because they're not sitting back necessarily calling you names. Some of the ignorant ones are. But some of these people making these decisions, they ain't using the N-word, at least openly. Their policies show how they feel about Black folks and how they feel about your progress moving forward. Mm. They making plans to smash our children and children's children into a second and third class status in this country. The question is, what do we plan to do about it? It's plenty of strategies and blueprints out here. This was one of them during this period. It's a blueprint. It's a strategy that our foreparents used. We can learn from their mistakes. We're going to take a brief break. And like I said, you can get involved in the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Time for Awakening. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time Time for an Awakening. Time for an Awakening. With host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
I think you'll find, sir, that there will come a time when black people wake up and become intellectually independent enough to think for themselves. As other humans are intellectually independent enough to think for themselves, then the black man will think like a black man, and he will feel for other black people. And this new thinking and feeling will cause black people to stick together. And then at that point, you'll have a situation where when you attack one black man, you are attacking all black men. And this type of black thinking will cause all black people to stick together. And this type of thinking also will bring an end to the brutality inflicted upon black people by white people. And it is the only thing that will bring an end to it. No federal court, state court, or city court will bring an end to it. It's something that the black man has to bring an end to himself.
Now you preachers and leaders, you administrators, you teachers, you leaders, you are the worst. No cowardly, punctified leader will lead this new generation of young black men and women. Your day of leading them is finished. You can't feel it? When you talk to young people, you can't feel that you're missing them? Parents, you can't feel when you're talking to your children that this is a new generation and they don't want to hear your compromising talk? Did you hear them in Ferguson tell Jesse, get the hell out of here? You ain't no leader. I was hurting for my brother because Jesse worked hard for our people. But time has moved on. And what was good yesterday ain't no good at all today. So either you become a new vessel so that new wine can be poured into the old wineskin, or your day of leading our people is over and it will never come back to you again. We're still in the land of our bondage. We're still in the land of captivity. We're still a slave to the Democratic Party. Still a slave to the Republican Party. You can't even see a Freedom Party. You don't see it. You're a slave. I'm a slave. And unless we admit that we are slaves, then we can never get free. Never get free.
Who put the present Democratic administration in Washington, D.C. The whites were evenly divided. It was the fact that you threw 80% of your votes behind the Democrats that put the Democrats in the White House. When you see this, you can see that the Negro vote is the key factor. And despite the fact that you are in a position to be the determining factor, what do you get out of it? The Democrats have been in Washington, D.C. only because of the Negro vote. They've been down there 4 years, and all other legislation they wanted to bring up, they brought it up and gotten it out of the way, and now they bring up you. And now they bring up you. You put them first, and they put you last, because you're a chump. A political chump.
So you could see that the government of America has been planning our demise. Any members of Congress here, any members of the civil rights movement that are here, you love this nation. You've suffered every indignity to make America better, that she might be great. And every time you forced her to make a law that was in our favor, they came right behind that law with skill and chicanery to make the law of non-effect. When it came to treating the citizens of African descent fairly, America failed. She put them in chains. The government put them on slave quarters, put them on auction blocks, put them in cotton fields, put them in inferior schools, put them in substandard housing, put them in scientific experiments, put them in the lowest paying jobs, put them outside the equal protection of the law, kept them out of their racist
bastions of higher education and lock them into positions of hopelessness and helplessness. The government gives them the drugs, builds bigger prisons, passes a three-strike law, and then wants us to sing God Bless America? No, no, no. Not God Bless America. God damn America. That's in the Bible for killing innocent people. God damn America for treating our citizens as less than human. God damn America, as long as she tries to act like she is God and she is supreme.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And we're having a critical discussion tonight on that period in the history of this country called Reconstruction, from 1865 to 1877. We're looking at it from an African Senate perspective, looking at it from the things that our ancestors tried to do during that period and what happened historically during that period to derail the things that they were trying to do, and also an historical overview on looking back, the lessons that we could learn, how we can use that as a blueprint, and things that we can institute that our ancestors tried to do during that period to move forward. Richard, you there?
Yeah.
We talked about the political motivations of our ancestors, but let's look at, because you mentioned to me, and I forgot the term you used. I think you said that they're entrepreneurs now.
Political entrepreneurs.
Yeah. But let's flip the script now. Let's look at the church's role in this. See, because the black church during that period had a huge role in educating our people. A lot of the schools that was talked about in that article was in churches. But something has happened to the black church during, from that black, just like the black politician of that period was totally different, the black church is totally different. What we see now, that's not what we seen then. You got entrepreneurs that's in the pulpit.
Yes.
And all they want is more money, and ways to generate more money and more membership.
And no social responsibility, and no understanding. And I'm being arrogant with this, Elliot. No understanding that when you build an organization, you're building a technology. And when you're in a capitalist country, a world capitalist system that puts you in, that navigates you for survival within that system. And it seems that they don't have, as leaders of that institution, that organization, they don't have that kind of social capital. So their real fallback is, and this is my opinion, relating to individual success. See me, what I can do, you can do it too. I'm not giving you the tools to do it. I'm just telling you to help me so you can see me so you can do it too. That's a different kind of, a different type. It's a part of the American philosophy, rugged individualism, a value. It's a value. But I think that that's a value that came, that over time, successions of the military state involvement with church institutions, church leaders, navigated them to. Because I want to believe that that came at the same time, the greatness of, and I'm calling it greatness, of these here political entrepreneurs who had no more social responsibility to the people that they come out of. And I place that around 72, coming out of the as a defeat, the military coming against black power, black economic and political movement which was another era. Because remember, in that 69 to 72, really further back, coming out of the Civil Rights Movement, they were saying they wanted land. Republic of New Africa said five states. They wanted independent economics. Kwame Ture said he wanted to be connected to, you know, having relationship with the colonial power, African states that are fighting against colonialism around the world. African people are fighting against colonialism around the world. They even was pushing again to take a United States to the UN against crime against humanity on the world stage. So these leaders of these organizations, I believe they, you know, that generation, they succumb to what's the easiest, what's the path of least resistance? Is it organizing your people or looking out for yourself?
Richard, let me, you know, one of the things that that we can use as a learning tool or teaching tool is, and I had it here. Let me pull it back up. And I remember when we had, I think it was James Lance Taylor that was on talking about the Colored Farmers Alliance. And that's something that we can look at as a guide or as a learning tool to what the power of our people could do during that period and do even now. Now, the Colored Farmers Alliance, because I just had where I didn't want to read all of this. I just wanted to read a portion of it. That within 5 years after that organization was started, it had become one of the largest in the country. Now, let me read, because, you know, blacks couldn't get into the Farmers Alliance, so they started their own. The Colored Farmers Alliance was established as a farmers organization and was explicitly not a political organization. It soon spread to every southern state through a combination of word of mouth and diligent organizing. By 1891, the Colored Farmers Alliance had approximately 1.2 million members. The membership, of whom 300,000 were females, 150,000 males were under 21 years of age, leaving 750,000 adult males. Now, again, Richard, again, here we go. Culture is involved in this, because as you see, white women, you know, the thing they want to always tout, they couldn't smoke a cigarette or vote until the 20s. They weren't involved with their men, or they were involved with their men as far as enslavement of us. They were just as involved. But as far as policy, they weren't involved with their men. You see here in this Colored Farmers Alliance that boasted 1.2 million members, that you had a cross-section of 300,000 females, 150,000 males under 21, and the rest of them was adult males. And then they had the membership broken down by states. Alabama had 100,000 people. Georgia had 84,000. South Carolina had 90,000. Mississippi, 90,000. Texas, 90,000.
Hold on a second.
Texas, 90,000. Arkansas, 20,000. Louisiana, 50,000. Virginia, 50,000. Kentucky, 25,000. Tennessee, 60,000. And North Carolina, 55,000. Now, and they were putting people in office that were going to try to meet their needs. But look again to what we were talking about and what smashed that organization. was that cotton picker strike of 1891. Now, let me read just what it states here, Richard, and listening audience can read it if they're not aware of what had happened. It says the cotton picker strike of 1891 was a labor action of African-American sharecroppers in Lee County, Arkansas, in September of 1891. The strike led to an open conflict between strikers and plantation owners. Racially motivated violence broke out. Both the sheriff's posse and the lynching party. Plantation managers were killed, two striking workers, and some 12 strikers were killed during the incident. Nine of those strikers were hung in a mass lynching the evening of September 29th. Now, it's stated that that broke the back of the Colored Farmers Alliance when they were attacked because they wanted more money. I think they wanted a dollar. It says here that the black farmers wanted committed to a strike for a dollar per 100 pounds of cotton. They wanted more money.
Mm-hmm.
And evidently, white farmers was getting more money, and they wanted the same.
Mm-hmm.
So a strike broke out. They were attacked. And this is what happened. And it broke the back of the Colored Farmers Alliance because of that incident. So again, we see some of the same things as before that happened to a lot of the black enclaves and towns that our ancestors didn't learn that they had to protect themselves by any means necessary because you were dealing with the people that were ruthless. Our ancestors stated that these people hated them. So those are the we can learn from these. We can learn from some of these historical accounts because we can do these things again. It's nothing stopping us from organizing. Right. It's nothing stopping us from politically organizing in these towns where we are the predominant population and cultivating people that will act in our interests the same way the original black elected official acted in the people's interests. And again, according to Lewis Gates of his research, I'll state what he stated in his documentary, that the black politician during that period wanted two things, wanted to improve their communities and to be economically independent from white society.
But, you know, I agree that those are the two principles. And, you know, one thing that I just wanted to put out there, because it's another value that we have to see that, and that's that individualism when we're looking at now, because all of us have to take individually, have to take this the responsibility. All of those individuals who were enslaved, they individually, it wasn't nobody leading the flock, you know. They were members. They were men and women who were leaders of flock, but they weren't leading the flock. But so that individualism and deal with that nonviolent, at least the protectionism part of that being under in a hostile environment. But one thing that I think, Elliot, that I wanted to share that when we talk about Reconstruction, that was an outgrowth when we were talking about also an African-centered perspective of looking at it. And that is the knowledge production that was produced by men that came out of it. Because I think that if I can share a chronicle of historians that come out that reviewed that period, looking at it because they felt that what whites were talking about and state, you know, the coming out of the academy of the Reconstruction period was not appropriate as it relates to the black experience or the African American experience or African experience. Looking at that, and I'm talking about the work that W.E.B. Du Bois did on Black Reconstruction.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I'm looking at David Levering Lewis, piece that he did on Du Bois. But I thought this was, when we talk about the knowledge production, because we have to critically assess using the facts that we discover to put an understanding together. In a section, it deals with that little wonder Du Bois would lament in the final pages of Black Reconstruction. He was writing in a field devastated by passion and belief. A small number of Negro authors and scholars equally ignored or dismissed by white academics and the mainstream public had begun to join Du Bois in the seemingly futile venture at rehabilitating the post-Civil War history of their people. In 1913, the remarkable John R. Lynch, elected Speaker of the Mississippi House of Representatives at the age of 24 and U.S. Congressman 2 years later, published Facts of Reconstruction, a valuable reminiscence taken seriously by no more than a handful of scholars, mainly those who subscribed to Woodson, then New Journal of Negro History. Literature professor Benjamin Brawley, pioneering a short history of the American Negro, however inadequate the task of refuting the Dummonites, also appeared that year. The book would serve as invaluable fiction for more than a decade as the unique textbook suitable for Negro history courses at Fisk, Morehouse, Howard, and other historically Black colleges. A minuscule group of scholars went to earn a doctorate at Chicago and Harvard in order to form around Du Bois and Carter Woodson a dedicated cohort of Davids to challenge the Gothics of white history. James Hugo Johnson, Luther Porton Jackson, and Charles Wesley, along with several others from historically Black colleges, were joined by Rayford Logan, who did Betrayal of the Negro, that laid out the whole Chinese thing, and the wonderfully named Aretheus Ambush Taylor, both graduates of mainstream Northern scholars. That Negro production, that Black production of thought, of historic, of correcting, or at least providing an African perspective of what occurred during Reconstruction, it's the basis that we're making our analysis on. And I think that that is so important that we have to continue to produce and disseminate the perspective, or as you say, the analysis, so that we can be able to utilize the model, but also correct the inconsistencies that have occurred over time. Because now, if, like you said, you know, and Henry Louis Gates is doing Black, the Reconstruction period, or Ava DuVernay doing 13th, and the brother that did, Wilmington on Fire, and others. You know, if we don't have that, we can't make a critical assessment of now from then. So I thought that was just something to show that what came out of those Black colleges, which came out of those Black people who took education, they didn't just produce land, they produced ideals, they produced scholars that gave us correct understanding of how we should look at the future by looking at the past. I just thought that was important to share.
Yeah, listen, you're right, because we not only have to look at the circumstances, but we have to look at the people who we've been dealing with. That's what's really important. Some of our people look at these things like in a lens or a small glass, like, well, you know, Bobby's all right with me, so that's all that counts. It's not about anything personal. When those men came out of that situation of our people being all of our people being in chattel enslavement, they didn't look at it like a personal thing. I'm out. You do you, I'll do me. That wasn't like that. especially the men that was in those political offices. Mm-hmm. They was all about their people. We got to change our mindset. That's what has hurt our people over these past 100 years, a little bit long. We started adopting white values, and it became a part of us. That stuff is killing our people. It's detrimental to our people.
And that is definitely, when we're dealing with, even if we are going to, if nonviolence or individualism as values are going to be the values that we're going to hold on to, then we have to create a strategy or a technique or a technology, a social strategy, a social technique, a social technology that can protect our situation. I mean, other than that, we'll be zombies. That makes no sense. Those, the first people on the planet acknowledging it, the first people who can be able to bring arts and science and civilization to the human family, the first people who have been able to endure the most brutal. And I know slavery has existed since mankind. I hear that. I haven't seen, and believe me, I haven't. It's a lot I haven't seen, but I have not seen anything that shows the brutality that the human being called African has experienced under this particular type of slavery has existed ever before and come out of.
And that's the key. That's the key, Richard, and come out of it. That's the key. That's the key. That come out of it.
Yes. That, you know, and that's something, acknowledging the pain of it, acknowledging and celebrating that we went through it, and looking at the contributions we've given to humanity by having this particular experience. That's nothing to be, you know, shy about, and it's definitely something to conserve and protect. But what's going on now is not doing either one.
Let me, we got a few minutes. Let me grab a couple of these calls that's sitting here, Bridget.
Yes.
Let's go to Newport News. Newport News. Newport
News. Hey, can you hear me? I've got some, I'm out in the shop, so I really wasn't sure if you get too much noise in the background. Are you gentlemen there?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I mean, you're really going over a deep conversation. I didn't get in until we were well into an hour. I had some other business to take care of with family. But what I was going to say is you covered a lot of stuff, but I'm just going to say this, Bro Elliot. I had an experience in 1976 where I was coming across country and I stopped in Arkansas with an Air Force buddy. And I had two ladies and an older gentleman tell me, I don't want to give the name of the town because I know my buddy listens and I don't like to give people's personal information. But I had two women go into tears telling me about their experience when the people in, I believe it was Elaine, Arkansas, or Eleanor, Arkansas, something like that, well, about 230-some black people got lynched in less than something like 72 hours or 4 days or something like that. And it was tens of thousands of white people that did that. And that lady was saying to me that even when she was trying to ask her mother how come they didn't fight back, how come they fight back, her mother would just go into tears and tremble because of the vileness of what was done to them. Now, if you can imagine a town where you lose 230-some people in less than 4 days, lynched and burned and tarred or whatever, and nobody comes to help you, I understand that trauma. I mean, I understand it as best I can from watching her experience. So, and I'm going to say to you something else. She followed that up with, for years after that, those people couldn't buy bullets in that town or in its surrounding counties. If they were caught, you know, back then you could load your own shot and stuff. She said that the people who were gunsmiths and stuff like that, the white boys would only give them so much, you know, measured off. And if anything was missing, you could get fingers cut off, anything. Now, this woman told me this in my lifetime at about 25, 26 years old. And what I told people about it during that time, you know, before I really got into this part of, you know, being aware of it, I'm telling you, so many people in this country are traumatized by that and have been raised to say, keep your head down, stay out of trouble, just survive, just survive. Now, I'm going to say this to you. I may not have agreed with that. They made that choice. But my thing now is, instead of us uniting now and using the newer tools and our intellect to fight for justice for our ancestors and our future, we still have people insisting that something like even that thing with ADOS, rather than sit at a table and figure out how to advocate to force this H.R. 40 and all of that through and get our people behind making this country do some kind of reparations for us, what we find is what happened to me when I called into a show or actually listened to the show last Tuesday, and I'm not going to make this too long. I heard a vice mayor from Newark explaining that for us to be successful, all we got to do is register for minority loans and got to get smart about our farming and everything. So rather than argue with this young man, he's about 50 years old, I called him a young man, because he was saying how ignorant we are. I told him about Tom Burrell, the black farmers, and the show you just had last week, and pinned it in the comments. You know what he told me? That's what's wrong with us. We're living in the past. That shit is old. That shit is dead. Now, I'm going to say this to you. You and I may not agree with that, but that is what's wrong with the mindset of our people. They would rather find a way to fit in, and it's just like the people when I was in the military raising hell, and the white boy told me, my squadron commander told me, you got to learn to assimilate. And I said, no, sir. Constitution gives me a right to integrate, to be who I am, do this goddamn job, pardon my French, and maintain military bearing, but do for me. I don't have to do anything to advance you. My loyalty is with my people. That man tried to throw me out of the military. I went before court-martial and everything, and they left me alone because when they tried to give me a lawyer, I said, no, I don't need one. I'm telling you, you have no right to tell me the only way I can survive and be free is to be like you. I am not you. Most of our people don't do that. They do exactly what that vice mayor did. Shut up, get yours, and to hell with anybody else, because they ain't got it, because they won't work hard enough. Our people have become individualists.
Yeah.
They don't know how to, quote, hold yourself to a high standard and then try to bring along someone else. Instead, they do just like I had a conversation with one of my older sisters. They go to church, and they can tell you everything Miss Susie wore 3 weeks ago, if she wore the same hat, what's wrong with her and all of that, because you got to dress up to serve your Lord. But you ain't got to put a dime toward trying to emancipate your people, because all you need to do is look good and feel good, and you free in America. I'll leave it right there, but I can tell you more. I wish I could chat with you gentlemen offline, because I really like your platform, but I'm going to be perfectly honest with you. Until we sit down and get an understanding, communicate with each other, instead of throwing slogans, we're never going to make it as a people. And I'm going to put this out there in the public, because I got banned from Twitter, locked out of my Twitter account, for texting some information that included Greg Carr from Howard University. And I went back and forth with Twitter and finally had to go online with them and told them I refuse to take down something that is a piece of information that is factually correct just because somebody got a damn PhD behind their name. Your title doesn't make what you say true. And out of respect for Bruce Dixon, I'm going to tell you this. Before he passed, I sent him verifiable, quantifiable information that piece that you played the other day in honor of him. I went down the list and showed him five different things that were wrong and gave him the information. And you know what he wrote back to me? Well, materially, it may be inaccurate, but the essence of it is true. I don't have patience for people that don't want to acknowledge facts that do not match their ideology. We will never get anywhere if we don't be honest with each other, that we can disagree among ourselves, but when it comes to freedom and reparation, there is no option for failure unless we fail to do this together. I'm going to leave it there.
Thank you for your call, brother.
I agree.
Let's finish up with 602. Let's go to 602.
Yes, brothers. Good evening. Brother Marcus here.
No worries, sir.
I'm doing great, good brothers. You know, it's you know, we got to remember, you know, we're dealing with a megalomaniac, you know, a homicidal maniac, a kleptomaniac. This man here that we're dealing with, you know, is just a stone cold killer.
Yes.
See, so it ain't a matter of, you know, our people made any errors. We just dealing with a killer. He don't care. No matter how you twist it, no matter how you turn, you try to, well, let us live in our own neighborhood. He come there, he bomb it, he burn it, kill our people. Oh, well, let's try to integrate. He come there, he terrorize us. So this man is unrelenting. And, you know, we didn't have no defense at the time when our people was making those moves. We never have no defense. Who was the defense? The Union Army? The same Union Army that did that to black people down here in the Devil's Punch Bowl, that let 20,000 black men, women, and children die in that Devil's Punch Bowl in Mississippi, Natchez, Mississippi. These people don't care. They don't care. We got to get power. We got to get a black army, navy, air force, marines, nuclear weapons, whatever the hell everybody got, we got to get that. And then he going back off. He don't listen to powerless people. He don't listen to powerless people. He respect power. See? And look, we're in prison here. We're living with this man. We're living in prison here with him. Mm. He could turn the water off, turn the electricity off. You gonna fight him? Yeah, all right. You gonna fight? Okay, turn the water off, turn the power off. We are, you know, right here in Memphis. We surrounded all by white folks here. All around us is white folks. See where we live down here in Memphis. In Detroit, it's probably the same thing. So I'm saying we're surrounded with these people. These people are well entrenched in this country. They're dug in. We ain't got no ammunition. That's what you need to fight, ammunition. You got to have some anti-aircraft, as a rocket launcher too, because they'll drop a bomb on you. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, the only out I see for our people is to get out. I don't think we could legislate, you know, these people. No matter how they give you a law, they change it when it's to their benefit. They give us a law now, and then next couple of years, you know what, you know, let's change that law. See? So, you know, you can't depend on their laws to work. The only out is to get out. That's what I think. And we got to get... Africa got to get strong. Africa got to be able to respond to this man. See, we got to have a big black army over there. That when he have to fool, they could. You see, why he don't? You don't see him lynching no Chinese people. Cause China got 1.4 billion Chinese there ready to respond. They say, hell, we could lose 400 million people. We don't care. See, so. You know, that's what frustrates our people so much. It's frustrating because, you know, we have prayed, we have begged, we have what haven't we done in America to get, you know, to let this man know, hey, he don't care. He don't have no soul. He's a soulless person. He ain't a human. He just got human form, but he definitely ain't human. I say, Africa for the Africans, those at home and those abroad. Anyway, good brothers, thank you so much for this program. I appreciate you guys.
Peace, sir.
Peace.
Richard, we come to the end of another program, and I, you know, I'll probably get in touch with Dr. Rogers. I know that he wanted to be involved in this discussion, I guess, after he lost his phone. I guess he's trying to scramble to get it. But we can always reach out to him and continue the discussion, because, you know, I guess there's certain things that he wanted to bring up that we might not have touched on, which is, you know, is a good thing, that because this won't be the end of any discussion that we have. These things need to always be on the table. But, you know, we'll reach out to him and continue this discussion. And again, Richard, I want to I don't know whether it's this week's program or next week, but the two farmers that was mentioned in that article that was on Time for Awakening, the Facebook page is planning to have them on the program to talk about what's going on with the poultry farmers in this country. We talked about Friday, and the listening audience that didn't hear, that these unrelenting attacks just continues. You know, we had Mr. Slaughter on. It was one of the named plaintiffs from that Pickford versus Glickman lawsuit. Tell us that they never got a chance to have an open hearing on the charges, to present their case in open court, and that they just continue to they just hold that debt over them. I think he mentioned that his is 12 years. Another one of the named plaintiffs is 16 years. They're just waiting for the men to pass so they can take their land. That's what it's all about. And it's the same thing, Richard. It was about the same thing in 1865, 1875, 1885. It's the same thing. They didn't want blacks to have land and control the land, control anything dealing with agriculture. And these men are not gardeners. They own hundreds of acres of land. So we're going to have the farmers on to talk. In fact, we got to get an update from Mr. Burrell on that Stein seed lawsuit, one of the largest seed producers in the country, selling black farmers fake seed.
Right.
And until they had it analyzed, they go to the market, and your output is not the same as other white farmers. They're trying to another way to drive you out of business and land loss. So, you know, we'll continue the discussion, get those men on, try to line them up to be on the program to at least put the information out to the Time for Awakening audience. Before we go this evening, I want to make sure that I kind of showcase the programs Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. African Perspectives with Brother Oshi from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Always interesting dialogue and guest on African Perspectives with Brother Oshi. On Monday after this program, Black People's Matrix with Brother Franklin Jones from 1 to 3 on Time for an Awakening. From 6 to 8, Acres of Diamonds with Brother Jihad Ahmed from 6 to 8 on Time for an Awakening. From 8 to 9 tomorrow, the reparations program with in Cobra is scheduled to be on. I got to check because they're on twice a month, and I make sure that tomorrow is the Monday that they're on. I got to make sure of that. But anyway, tune in tomorrow after Acres of Diamonds, and you will probably hear Reparations Now by in Cobra and Brother Jamoke out of Atlanta, and usually has a co-host with him, but their program will be airing every other Monday on Time for Awakening from 8 to 9. On Tuesday, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers from 8 to 10 on Time for Awakening. On Wednesdays, Revive with Sister POC from 8 to 10 on Time for Awakening. On Thursday, Relationships with Joy and Troy from 7 to 8 on Time for an Awakening. And Time for an Awakening is back on Fridays from 8 to 10. I've been delaying and trying to wait until the website is complete. The new changes to the website is complete now. It's just some little things that's going to be added as far as in the marketplace section, the products page. And I'm going to do all I can to get the Warren Valentine show up and running from 10 to 12 on Time for an Awakening. So hold me to it, listening audience. If I come back here next Friday and it's not up, then you can call and roast me. But other than that, we're going to be airing the Warren Valentine show from 10 to 12, a nightly night talk program on Time for an Awakening. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
Peace.
Driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, or you're watching your children playing after school, they seem to be to take care of. We've got to do something, yeah, to save the children. Soon it will be their turn to try and save the world. To play such a small part of the thing that they'll soon be right at the heart of. My little Tommy, he said he wants to be a fireman. save the children. To save the children.